major presentation of our Mission Emphasis Days. It's my privilege to welcome into our midst again, he was here last night, but to welcome again Dr. Westcott, Executive Secretary, Board for Mission Services, also former missionary to Nigeria, as was Dr. Buckman, whom you heard this morning. Dr. Westcott will be addressing us on the matter of training for meeting the need for cross-cultural ministry abroad. Dr. Westcott?
I thought you were going to make a long speech.
No,
I sat down.
Thank you. My pleasure to be back here. I enjoy coming and sharing with all of you some of the things that are going on in our church and in the world and in the mission of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ in this world. I never cease to be amazed as I go around the church and talk to convocations and circuit meetings and congregations at how little people really understand, and that includes everybody. And I would put myself in that position 8 years ago when I took this job, really understand what is going on around us. How very little. What's going on in this country, what's going on in the rest of the world. And I will have questions coming from well-meaning people who will say to me, isn't the job done? Do we still have to send missionaries? No, you said you wanted to send 600 missionaries out in the world by 1990. Surely we don't really need to do that. That's just some sort of nice talk. The job is done. It's been 2,000 years since we heard the Lord say, go. And those people say that in all honesty, and I have a hunch that maybe some of you sitting here feel the same way. I've discovered that we do very little reading as professionals in anything outside of our given profession, and maybe we don't even read in our profession, but we surely don't read about what's going on in the world, and if we do, we don't seem to relate that to the church. Because you see, the world is still standing only because the church is not complete. It isn't standing for any other reason. And we've forgotten that. We talk about the signs of the last times, and we talk about blood and war and rumors and earthquakes and all this sort of stuff, and our people get upset, and we don't know what to do with all those things, so we leave them alone. There is a sign that is clear and simple, even a child can understand it, which is determines exactly when the end will come. And tells us why we're still here, if it hasn't come. And that sign is the Savior speaking, saying, my word shall be preached in all the world for a witness to all nations. Then the end shall come. And not until then. Has the end come? You're just like every congregation in Missouri. And I say this in my sermon. You know, has the end come? Everybody sits there and stares at me. I really don't quite know what's going on in the heads of a people in our church. I ask questions from the pulpit. I always have, and I expect responses. I used to encourage my people to laugh during a sermon. After all, I'm sure the Lord had many laughs at some of the things he said because he had a real sense of humor. Well, we don't. We sit like bumps on a log, stones carved out of granite. We don't do that when you watch a football game. Don't do that when you watch a soap opera. You don't do that when you watch a miniseries. You cry buckets of tears, you laugh, you jump, you scream, you yell. Come to worship the Lord, we sit, must not respond. May I try it once again? Has the end come?
No.
Thank you, appreciate that very much. I wasn't sure you knew. maybe you thought you were in heaven, who knows? We're obviously not in heaven. We're obviously not in heaven, so the job isn't done. And I guess part of my burden, and I didn't understand this until the Lord put me in this position, and I came into it screaming and kicking, and I'm grateful he did, out of Scottsdale, Arizona. Who wants to leave Scottsdale, Arizona to come to St. Louis? Nobody in his right mind. Dave Barth did, poor guy. At any rate, somehow we need to, for ourselves as pastors and future pastors and our people, to understand why we're alive, why the world still stands. It isn't some Ronald Reagan can play the bully or can threaten the bully or whatever he's doing. It isn't all of this stuff that goes on around us. The world stands for one reason only. And that is that somehow and in some way, His word of love and peace in Christ will reach those who have not yet heard it. He doesn't say that everybody in every nation will come. He says it will be preached to all nations. And that word nation is very important, because the world is not made up of countries. Some of you have heard me say this. That's not what you hear today, you will have heard me say before, because it all bears repeating. But the world is not made up of countries, the world is made up of nations. What do you think that figure was that Al Buckman kept throwing around in the sermon? 17,500. Where do you think that, what does that mean? That's a guess. It's an educated guess as to how many groups and subgroups of peoples there are in this world. And those 17,500 really are locked into a 2 million figure, Al, right? They're locked into those 2 million who have not yet heard and among whom there is no or a very small witness to Christ. 17,500. There are at least 17,500 nations. What's a nation? What's a people group? Well, a broad definition is that a nation really is a people group that has its own language. Speaks its own language, speaks it as its own government, its own culture. How many languages are there in the world? Oh, you heard me say this last year. What's the matter with you guys that were here last year? Come on. How many languages are there in the world? How many languages are spoken in the world today? 5,103, and I think it's now been upgraded to 5,400. We always keep finding new languages. Languages, ladies and gentlemen, not dialects. Languages, as indistinguishable as German is from Izzy. We're not talking about dialects, we're talking about languages. Now, many of these languages have other characteristics. There are some that spin off speaking the same language, but have a different culture or live in a different area. So it multiplies. But there are actually then 5,400 separate nations, if you wanted to really define it that clearly, in the world. Speaking their own language, having their own culture and their own government. And that's in, you know, this world in which we live, which we think speaks English everywhere we go. We don't even hear what's going on around us in this country. Now, last night we talked about the fact that the United States of America is today the largest mission field in the world. You missed it if you weren't here, and a lot of you weren't. There's only about 15 here. But it is the largest mission field in the world, and the Lord has made it so. See, that's the other great thing that you and I need to come to grips with again. We need to come to grips with, number one, why the world is standing, and we need to help our people understand that. It is not so we can plant space colonies or create a complete and total lasting peace on this earth. That's utter nonsense. It is so that people everywhere will hear about God's love for them in Christ, through those who already know it. And if I get on that one, my hour will be gone. But that's the way He has chosen. The mission is His, the message is His, the strategy is His, and what puts it all together is people in whom He lives, who know the message, who have tasted the sweetness of the mission, and have eyes to see and understand the strategy. He intends for others to hear through those who already know and have experienced His love. That's number one. Number two, we need to understand why things happen in this world. It's astonishing to me that every Sunday in the service, we give lip service to the fact that the Lord rules the world. Now, we'll even have Psalms that say He knows how many cattle are on the hills, and, you know, He does all of these things. He breaks the bow and cuts the spear. He does all of these marvelous things. And yet, as you listen to us talk in our everyday language, as you listen to us even, you know, put together sermons, and I've sat and listened. I do that now more than I preach. Listen to sermons. You don't hear anything about that at all. You hear an awful lot about man, about what he's doing. Who's in control of the world? Ronald Reagan. Gorbachev, whatever his name is in Russia. Castro in Cuba. Who's in charge of the world? He'll tell you. And that's not true. Who makes history? Not man. God. All of history is made by God. All of history. It has to be. He says so. You read your Old Testament. We don't do enough reading in the Old Testament. You know, he's just so very clear. So very clear. He raised up nations, put them down, turned them over, moved them around. He did it. Children of Israel did nothing but respond. Nor did the Philistines. Nor did anybody else. And nothing has changed. He still makes history. And why is history made? Why does the Lord continue to make history? So that in some way, somehow, people will hear about him and his love for them in Christ. This country is a classic illustration. As you study the scriptures, you will discover that God has two strategies for mission. We don't have strategies. I can't get this through my staff. I can't get this through anybody. We talk as though we're the ones who make the strategy. We don't make strategies, period. What we need to pray for, to have the eyes to see the strategy and to respond to it. Watch Al laughing back there. The staff knows this is a horse I ride. Because it is the Lord who is orchestrating it all. You and I need to have the kinds of eyes to see it so that we can respond. Two strategies for a mission run through the entire scripture. Read it. Read your Old Testament. Read your New. All of them describe, in both books, in both parts of the scripture, describe strategy for a mission. God's strategy, not ours. Illustration after illustration. The first strategy is clearly outlined and runs through most of the Old Testament. And for those who teach Old Testament, I wish they'd begin to teach this with Old Testament, because that makes it exciting. And that is that God brings people to the Word. The unbeliever is brought to the Word constantly throughout all of the Old Testament. It's the only thing that makes any sense out of the Old Testament. Jerusalem, crossroads of the Word. An odd, unique people, weird in many ways. But God put them in a place and caused that place to become the trade route, crossroads. Millions of people went through Jerusalem, and millions of people saw this weird, odd group of people that God had put together, and couldn't go through it without saying, "Why do you do that stupid thing?" Read Josephus. Read the Jewish historian. He'll tell you the result of that. Read Acts chapter 8. You got the result of it in an Ethiopian, the first missionary to Africa. Not just anybody, but the treasurer. He comes to Jerusalem on business. The unbeliever comes to the Word. His curiosity aroused. Doesn't get any answers. Lays out a tremendous amount of money and buys a scroll. No, we read that as though it were some, you know, we went to Dalton's bookstore and bought a paperback. How absolutely utter nonsense. That man laid out a small fortune to buy that scroll of Isaiah. You'd better believe it. So intense was his curiosity, so deep was his desire to understand what made those crazy people tick. And it took Philip to open it up. He comes to faith, and he's the first missionary in Africa. Brings Christianity to Ethiopia, because he wasn't just an ordinary businessman. He had the ear of the queen. And it spread from there. The end of the story is 1977. I don't have time to do that. So far, what I'm telling you is not anything I've got written on this outline. Well, anyway. At any rate. Okay. Strategy for a mission is to bring the unbeliever to the Word. Read the Old Testament now. Read it now. Even Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, all those nonsensical laws are mission strategy. I'm not crazy. Open your eyes. God prepares the people. Bring the unbeliever to the Word. That's what's happening to this country. Roger Mudd can tell us all he wants to. All the anchor men can tell us that, you know, we're being inflicted with these crazy, weird people from all over the world. And Castro is dumping his you know, prisoners and his terminally ill people on us. Castro's got nothing to do with it. God uses economic disaster, war, natural disasters, uses everything under the sun to move people. Why do you think we got this tremendous influx of Asians, people walking our streets speaking languages we didn't even know existed 15 years ago? God brought them here. They ended up in refugee camps, and they're here. They don't want to be here. By the way, get that in your heads also. They don't want to be here. They didn't ask to be here. They'd much rather be back in Vietnam, in Laos, in Cambodia. Much rather. but they're here. Why? That they may see Christ in those in whom Christ already lives. That's you and me. The first principle of evangelism is clearly enunciated in the New Testament. Nobody pays any attention to it. No, no, we have Kennedy, we have dialogue, we have all this kind of stuff. What is it? Al had it in his text today. It's my favorite text. He had another agenda as he used the text. I would have done it differently. He knows that. At any rate, what is it? We are his ambassadors. Paul begins by saying he doesn't call us believers. He calls us people in whom Christ lives. Hey, when Christ ascended, he didn't leave the earth. He took up residence inside of those who are his. And he looks out into the world through your eyes and mine. He's heard through your voice and mine. What else does the word ambassador mean? And don't mean just preachers. I'm sick of that. Those passages being interpreted as belonging exclusively to the ministry. It begins by saying, if anyone is in Christ, he is filled with Christ, he's a new creation. That's every believer. Every believer is an ambassador. That's how God determined that he would be visible in this world and give reality and truth to his words in the lives of his people in whom he lives, so that people will see Jesus Christ in your eyes and mine and hear it in your voice and mine. Now that's how God intended it to happen. So he brings all of these people, many who come from countries into which we can't send missionaries or into which it is difficult to send missionaries, brings them here, that they may see Christ. They would never see Christ where they lived, but they will now, hopefully. Unfortunately, they don't, all too often. We're still the most Christian country in the world, even though we are the largest mission field in the world, and that's happened in the last 15 years. That's number one. Number two, strategy of the Lord is to take the word to the unbeliever. And both of those strategies are at work in this world today with an intensity and a force as never before, bar none. I didn't understand this 9 years ago. I see it now. And I wish I could start my ministry all over, but if I did, nobody'd listen to me. At least with the gray hair, people do listen a little bit. They wouldn't have listened had I known this 30 years ago. They'd have laughed at me. I want to tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. The Lord is at work, and it's exciting to be alive. And if you don't see it, get the scales off your eyes and start looking at what's going on around you with those two things in mind. God's in control, and he's moving people that they may hear the word. And he may touch you and move you. Because I'm supposed to talk about cross-cultural. My topic is mission and ministry means training for multicultural outreach abroad. Well, I haven't got to abroad yet, have I? I'm talking about here. Because I'm going to tell you something. We've got to change our thinking about a lot of things. When people hear the Great Commission, go into all the world, and I wish Christ had never said it. I know that's heresy, but I wish he'd never said it. What do they think of? Think of Africa. Immediately their minds make a quantum leap all over the ocean to some other place. And the poor black man who lives next door, or the poor white man who lives next door, who doesn't know Jesus Christ, can die and go to hell, and nobody cries. But we cry about the Africans. We cry about, you know, the Asians or whatever. And we put our money in the plate and say we're doing mission work. We're not doing mission work at all. We've got to start to understand that where your feet hit the ground is where mission work begins. And Christ defined the Great Commission, and I wish those two passages would always be put together. In Acts chapter 1, verse 8, when the disciples were trying to argue with him about what was going to happen and why didn't he come back here and set up a nice big kingdom and run the Romans out of the world, you know. He said to them, what? You shall be my witnesses. Where? Where? Oh, surely you're not that biblically illiterate. Come on, quick, for the love of Pete. Where? In Jerusalem. What is Jerusalem? Right where you live. Right where you live. Where your feet hit the ground. Okay, so you don't live where you live, work where you work, play where you play by accident. You play there by design if you're one of God's children. By God's design, because he needs you in that place. You ever stop to think that in every strata of society, he has those in whom he lives? And the most exciting thing happened to me last week. I was talking just this way to a congregation, and I say in my sermon from corporate president to to garbage collector. And I've never had anybody respond to that. Guy came up to me last Sunday as he's shaking hands, my hand at the door, and said, "Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. I'm a garbage collector." I thought, I touched somebody. Nobody else heard, but he did. And his life will not be the same. Because God has placed us in all levels of society that they may see Christ. Lord, if it was up to you and me, we'd never get the job done. You know, we live in a little world all by ourselves. We see about, a group of people on Sunday morning. We never see anybody else. Our people do. They've got to understand why they're alive and why they live where they live. Okay, then the other one is that, we take the word to the unbeliever. Is there a need? Let me bore you for just a minute. Population of the world is 4.8 billion people. You need to know these things. They help you in understanding the enormity of the challenge and the reason why we must have every Christian enlisted, not just the select committees and those who carry the ordination on their head. Every Christian. That's what the Lord is expecting. That's why he's at work in this world with an intensity as never before. 4.8 billion people. How many are Christian? Well, thank God for computers. I thank him every night. They're a marvelous invention. I don't understand them. I don't understand what makes those little men run around, but they do. That's marvelous. With computers, we don't stand like the apostles did on that little hill. And Christ said to them, "Go out into the world," and they said, "What world?" They had no idea. They had no idea that there was a world out there. Well, today, there's no excuse. 4.8 billion people, between Al and myself, we could probably, if we had another hour, tell you everything you wanted to know about this 4.8 billion people, or close to it. We do know that there are 1.5 billion who claim to be Christian, but it only shakes out at about 500 million who are actually Christian. Because we include in that 1.5 billion everybody. Roman Catholic claims all of the world from south of Texas to the tip of the Argentina Horn. Lutherans claim all of the world across the Scandinavian countries. Nobody in either one of those areas of the world knows too much about Jesus Christ, including the 70 million Lutherans who live in Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Denmark. 5.1 million Lutherans people live in Denmark. 4.998 million are Lutherans. And we would all think, oh, the job's done. Denmark is claimed. Marvelous. Write it off. 4.998 million are Lutherans. Of those 4.998, 96% in a survey taken about a year and a half ago said, it was a survey on their lifestyle. They got no use for God in their life in answer to that question. No. So you call them, Christian? Not even Lutheran, Not Lutheran, let alone Christian. At any rate, that's the world. So we've got 1.5 billion who claim to be Christian. Let's leave them alone. That leaves you 3 billion people on the road to hell. And maybe that's part of the problem. I don't hear a lot of people or preachers from the pulpit talking about hell today. Are we afraid? Really afraid to say that there are, there are two places after death? Are we afraid to talk about that? I don't think I've heard the word hell. I think I heard, didn't you say it not too long ago in a sermon? You might be the only one. He's nodding his head nicely. Okay. Dean, very nicely he said that. Okay. But you don't hear it that often. You really don't. We talk such nice things. We moralize and we talk the law, but we don't put any punch into it. And therefore the gospel has no meaning. What am I escaping from? Well, I don't really know. There is a hell, believe me. And millions of people, billions of people will occupy it. And we'd better believe that. And that's what adds the urgency to what we're doing. Unless we see what the Lord is doing. His desire that no one perishes, but that everyone lives with him in eternity is very real. That's why he's moving all these people who don't want to be moved. Because he's got enough people in whom he already lives to get the job done tomorrow. That's the sad part. Because 1 billion of those 2 billion people live where other Christians live. 1 billion of the 3 live where other Christians already live. It means you don't have to kiss your mom and daddy goodbye and come to me and say, "I want to go overseas and live in a culture and learn another language and all of that nonsense." It means, you got people right next door to you. 1 billion people live where enough Christians already live. Get the job done. But that leaves you the 2 billion. 2 billion among whom very few Christians live. There are 17,500 groups. I don't know how many of the 5,400 languages are spoken in that 2 billion, but I would imagine the majority of them are, Al, right? Okay. So we have a job. We got a job to do in linguistics because 3,000 of those languages have no writing. Our church body is heavily involved in it. And God gives to his church men who have that ability, who have an ability to absorb language, to absorb the technical skills of linguistics, and to reduce languages to writing. Just last November, I guess it was, Al. Well, Al is also responsible for a New Testament. He's a linguist in the Yala language. We dedicated the Bokeh Bible, Old and New Testament, Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, as we move into this really last great frontier, because there's no way to reach these people unless we crack their language and reduce it to writing. And that's happening now with a rapidity that wasn't true years ago, because the science has increased and computers are involved in the action. Now, what's the world going to look like as we sit here in our complete, nice, quiet security in a couple of years? There's going to be some dramatic changes. Those changes are already taking place. By the year 2000, the population will probably be 6.2 billion. It will double in another 20 years. But of those 6.2 billion, by the year 2000, one half are going to live where? In cities. In cities. And that's going to change, drastically and dramatically change, the face of the earth, as well as make the reaching of people with the gospel increasingly more difficult. Al and I worked in Nigeria. I worked among five separate language groups. And I, in my day, you know, used an interpreter. We didn't learn the language. I couldn't have learned five languages anyway. I did learn one relatively well. But these were tribal people, and we lived back in the jungle. And they were, you know, they were reachable. Really, we could walk around and talk to them all when you get down to it. What do you do in a city? A tremendous challenge to the church. We're working in cities in Venezuela, because that's where the people are in Venezuela. And it's an unbelievable challenge. This country, cities. But what's really going to happen? Let me just give you some statistics. They're interesting. Cities over 100,000 today are 1,700. By the year 2000, there will be 2,200. Cities, megacities, we call them, over a million. Today are 286, will be 433. Super cities, over 4 million. Today there are 46. In the year 2000, there will be 79. Almost double. Over super giants, we call them. Cities over 10 million. Today there are 14. By the year 2000, there will be 24. There will be 8 cities that will have a population over 20 million. Most of those will be elsewhere in the world. New York, 23 million. Including the whole New Jersey complex. But all the other cities will be out there. Tokyo, Sao Paulo, Mexico City. 31 million for Mexico City. Can you imagine? The people will come from the land to the city in search of jobs. And we're going to have poverty like we have never seen. We're going to have crime like we have never seen. As we move into those years toward the year 2000. And a tremendous challenge to the church. It will not be going back into the bush. It will be going to the cities. And the cities of the world today are small by comparison to what will be happening in another 15, 14, 17 years. There are, besides Christianity, three other major religions in the world that you're going to have to factor into our knowledge and our preparation, because those three probably make up most of the 2 billion. That we're talking about. And those three religions are Muslim, 817 million. They grew in the last 5 years by 94 million. I want you to think of this, okay? We have suddenly entered a new era. The major religions of the world, all three of them, apart from Christianity, have decided to actively gain adherents. Now, Muslims always have. But they've increased the intensity with which they're doing it. Hindus and Buddhists never did, but they've changed. There's now a school for missionaries in India. And I'm not sure. I think there may be one in Japan. I'm not sure. It seemed like I read that somewhere. But there's one in India for Hindus and a school for Buddhists. But Muslims have grown. And you know what's happened to this country? Muslims? 15 years ago, there were 500,000. Today, there are 3 million Muslims. While you and I sit here and decide what we're going to do with our lives and whether or not we really want to get involved, Muslims are out there buying up as many Christian churches as they can. They will buy up every Christian church that has a for sale sign in front of it in the United States, Canada, and England. It's happening. But they don't do it in such a way that we notice it. You see, they know if they build a mosque, that, you know, we'll know what's going on. They don't want us to know what's going on. So they buy up a Christian church, gut the inside, leave the outside so it still looks like a Christian church, but turn the inside into a mosque. That's happening in this country, in Canada and in England right now. They are determined. There are, what, 37 countries in the world whose government is governed by Islamic law, I think. I just read that somewhere. I think it's 37 now, somewhere in that neighborhood. Governed by Islamic law, they are determined to be the religion of the world. And that determination they're carrying out. Buddhists and Hindus, now Hindus are the next largest group with 648 million. They grew by 64.8 million in the last 5 years. And that's phenomenal for the Hindus. Most their growth was always biological. So was the Buddhist. 300 million Buddhists grew by 22 million. So when you're talking about the world, you have to factor those in, and those represent the real challenges to the church. And we talk about cross-cultural ministry in this country, and we talk about cross-cultural ministry overseas. And today we do need, I'm going to be running out of time very shortly, so today we do need, there isn't any question about it, dedicated young men, old men, middle-aged men, whatever, and women, who are willing to do what is really beyond any doubt, today more than ever before, a real sacrifice. We're not talking about somebody going out for 3 years and, you know, messing around with a group of people and upsetting everything and then coming back home because they didn't like it. We're talking about people who have a commitment to a life to live in another culture, to learn another language, to live in that culture, to become a part as much as possible of that culture. We never do. No one ever becomes a part of another culture other than their own. Totally and completely. Never. But at least we can become a part of it so that we're accepted and we can begin to bring to them the gospel. And many, many times this will take a 5-year period as you learn the language, as we become a part and it can be accepted by them and they begin to trust us. All of that. Now, I'm supposed to talk about cross-cultural training. Well, you obviously don't get that in an institution like this. I don't think you can. I'll be very fair. I used to think we could. When I first took the job, I didn't understand why you didn't have certain courses here, but I think I begin to understand why you can't. However, you can't go over without preparation. As little as you can really go into the cross-cultural milieu of this country without some understanding that you are in a cross-cultural situation. No, part of the reason why we make mistakes is ignorance. Nor do we recognize that we're in a cross-cultural situation. If you did, you wouldn't do so or say some of the things that you do and you say. So that we do need training. What our church does at this point until we get something better, and one of the things I hope before I retire is to get something better, is we use an institution called Link Care Center out on the west coast of this country for 4 weeks with some very good experts. It's made up of psychologists who are Christian, Reformed, I agree, not Lutheran, but who all have overseas experience and who deal with the missionaries that we send, the candidates, and experienced pastors that we send overseas in a way which we believe is the best that we can find to date. Cross-cultural experience, training for cross-cultural experience is a fairly complicated thing. And it isn't taking some courses at a summer school. A lot of it has to be learned, but there are some basic principles that need to be absorbed. And we believe that at Link Care, at least the beginning is made in that. There's a lot of work done by the staff as we talk with and relate with those who we've asked to go overseas. But more and more and more, the need is going to be for young people and older people to do this. We're facing a crisis as far as I'm concerned. We have said that we would like to have, under God's blessing, 600 missionaries out among these people among whom there is no witness by the year 1990. By the way, let me just make one comment on that. That is critically important. With the 2 billion people and the 1 billion among whom other Christians live, if we're going to use both the manpower and the financial resources of this church body, well, if we're going to make the most out of that which the Lord gives us, we have to very carefully make sure that whenever we talk about beginning new work, we are beginning work among a group of people who don't have a gospel witness. We began work since 1980 in 18 new nations. I'm pleased with that. From 58 to 78, this church body didn't begin in a new nation. We did maintenance work. But suddenly the Lord is opening doors. And since 1980, we have walked into 18 new nations, most among whom there is no Christian witness of any kind. Al goes out to Africa, makes a trip. Part of his trip usually is to take a look at another tribe, another nation. He walks through it. He eyeballs it. He rides motorcycles. He rides trucks. He stands on his head. He does whatever. In order to get a visual picture of what's going on. If he sees Baptist missionaries, if he sees Episcopalian missionaries, we say to them, God bless you, and on we go. We will not go into competition. There's not enough time and there's not enough resources to do that. If the gospel is being brought, we will seek the tribe where it is not, and there are enough of them. All 18. Well, maybe I could be challenged on two. So I'll say all 16 of the 18 are tribes that Al surveyed or somebody else surveyed and among whom we found no gospel witness. That's important to know. I was a part of a meeting in Scotland, and I was the only mainline exec there. It blew my mind. It was billed as one of the great mission meetings of the world. And I thought, well, all mainline execs, I'll go. And I was the only mainline exec there. Were no Presbyterians, no Episcopalians, no Roman Catholics. Well, the word Roman Catholic wouldn't have been. I guess they should be excluded. It was kind of a Reformed Protestant meeting. At any rate, we joined together. There were 500 of us there. We joined together in a pledge to the Lord that by the year 2000, working together, we would plant one Christian congregation in each one of the 17,500 unreached groups in the world, people groups in the world. I feel a little bit proud that the Lord has heard that and he has enabled our church, as a small part of the whole Christian church on earth, to move into 18 of those. At least we understand why we're here as a church body. Now I got off the track. What was I going to end up with? Oh, 600 missionaries. After I was talking about 600 new missionaries by the year. Thank you for that. Well, somebody's listening. That's marvelous. That's marvelous. Even after an hour, he was still listening. By the year 1990, 600 missionaries. The way things look, we're going to have to change how we go about this. I don't believe we're going to have enough ordained clergymen to do that. We're talking about opening 500 new missions in this country per year. Per year. 500 new congregations in this country per year. And talking about 600 missionaries in the world. So we're going to have to use the vast resources that are available to us in other areas of training. We're going to have to use lay people. What we're doing right now is we're using DCEs, pairing them up with ordained clergymen, letting them be under the supervision of ordained clergymen, DCEs, teachers, whatever. We simply will not be able to do the job with the ordained clergymen unless there's a radical upturn in enrollment in our seminaries. We'll barely be able to meet the needs, you know, in this country. We won't even meet those needs if we open up 500 new churches next year, which under God we can do. Nobody believes that, but we can. We really can. We set our mind to it. You're going to end up being very key. You may end up in the next 15 years finding yourself in supervisory positions. We're using that with Walter Moss, a veteran missionary in Togo, supervising the work of three DCEs as they plant churches in tribes that don't have the gospel among them. We'll see how it works. But I'm convinced that we're going to have to be as innovative and creative as the human mind can be. And that really, you know, there's no limit to that if we put ourselves to it. And if we are convinced together, it's a reason why you're in ministry and I'm in ministry. The reason why the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod still exists as a part of the whole Christian church on earth. If we understand and are convinced of why those statements are true, we'll get the job done. We'll find a way to do it. And we'll mobilize 3 million people that belong to this church body to do it. Thank you. I think I'm supposed to quit. Or have I got 15 more minutes? What does it say? Harvey, what does it say?
We have an hour.
I have an hour. Now I got to pick up things I omitted. I'll tell you what. Why don't we open it for questions? No, you've been sitting a long time. And I'm sure one question will spark 30 minutes from me, but, you know, give it a whirl. Anybody got any questions? Anything that you'd like to discuss or whatever? In this country? Well, let me tell you what we're doing in Venezuela. Okay, that's a classic example because Venezuela is a country that really is made up of cities. There are very few people in the countryside. Oil rich or oil poor, whichever way you want to put it today. People have moved into cities in Venezuela. If you look at the map, you will see cities from east to west, and all of them of fairly large size, 100,000, 200,000 or better. Our strategy in Venezuela has been rather hit and miss because it is difficult to know. So you send a missionary and a DCE, that's where we started at first in Venezuela, into Maturin. City of, I don't remember, 250,000 or whatever. But city, okay, how now do you do this? Okay, first of all, obviously you're going to have to know the language because you can't do anything else. You've got to learn that language. And then what do? You go and knock on doors. Well, it doesn't work. It doesn't work in most cultures. I'm not even sure it works here. But nevertheless, it doesn't work in most cultures. How then do we do it? Well, there was a great deal of hit and miss that went on. We rented a store, for example, in Maturin. It was the second floor of a store, and we hung a sign out. Down in the middle of the city, hard to reach. Nobody saw it except during the week they see the sign. Well, a small group began to gather. Well, just recently, to make a long story short, we did a thorough reanalyzation analysis of what we were doing and decided that if we're serious about working in the cities, which is, you know, we could have abandoned that and gone back to the countryside where we started, okay? You know, that'd be nice, comfortable. That we had to change the strategy, and we had to change the method, not the strategy. See how they've even brainwashed me to use the word. But it changed the method, because that's all we're involved in, is methodology. We're involved in strategy. Okay, so what we did was decide that if you're going to do a job responsive, we began to look at, you know, we're also very slow, by the way, at looking what other groups do. You know, somehow we think we have the only answer to everything that goes on. You know, I'm being very facetious, obviously, and I'm overstating it, but we do. Now, and if we ask the Baptist, well, can't we talk to those people because they immerse people? Well, you know, sure you can talk to them. Sure you can talk to them. Because they've got the methodology that's marvelous. They've been planting 365 churches a year for the last 25 years in this country. Oh, maybe we can learn a few things. So we talked to the Reform. We talked to some of the Baptists. We talked to some of the Pentecostals, who are really the ones making the inroads in all of that part of the world. Central America, Mexico, Central America, Venezuela, and Bolivia, etc., Pentecostals are moving. And we need to analyze how they're doing it. So in talking, we discovered that they do some saturation work, which we've never done. Well, we've got enough missionaries in Venezuela that we had scattered really throughout, I think, 8 or 9 cities. So what we did was we concentrated. We're going to put teams of 4 or 5 in a city. Blanket. We have the radio, Lutheran Hour. Excellent Lutheran Hour program in Venezuela. And what we have not been able to do is follow up on the contacts. okay, that come through those who listen. And we're going to have to rely more and more and more, as we talk about urban work, on media to get the message out in some form or other. And so in Venezuela, then we're going to put four or five pairs in one city. We're going to abandon some areas. What we've also done, by the way, this is very fascinating, we have agreed to take from Brazil two pastors and team them up with Americans. Now, see, Brazil is our largest partner church. Brazil has 160,000 members. They have two seminaries, and they have lots of students. And they're growing, but they also want to go beyond their borders. So we're absorbing two Brazilian pastors, which should be very interesting. See how this works in a mixed team. And we're going to blanket the city. Part of also what we may have to do, and we're not certain about this, is we have to get some visibility. Some groups will buy land and build a building, so there is visibility. I'm not yet ready to buy into that. Because, you see, I'm a great believer that the church should be, from its very inception, apart from the missionaries, be indigenous, be self-supporting, self-governing, self-propagating. We have too many missions around the world, not just Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, but all denominations that are there because we pay, and we pay. We pay pastor salaries from St. Louis that are living in Argentina. Well, when I took over, I issued an order, and it went around the world. I wasn't very popular for a while, but it's shaking down a little bit. But that's going to stop in 5 years. How dare you, Westcott? Because I got my hand on the faucet. That's how I dare. Try me. That's how I dare. No question about it. Because this whole matter, then, of being indigenous from the very beginning is important. And the people have ownership. It's their church. It's not somebody else's. So that's what we're trying in Venezuela. Whether or not we'll be able to duplicate this elsewhere, I don't know. I also think in regards to... I'll get your question in a minute. I also think in regards to cities that our church has to respond. This is going to be an unbelievable milieu that the city presents. Okay, it presents everything from the very poor to the very rich. You know, somehow the church in Venezuela, when I came there, was ministering only to those in barrios, only to the poor. And I said to the missionaries, and I said, you have consigned the rich to hell, apparently. Because you're not working among anybody except the poor. Surely, if you're going to build an indigenous church, the Lord gave other people some money so they could support the church. You know? So we do have to bring them. He said, "Come, they will come through that little gate, but they'll come. You may have to drag them in, but they're there, and they'll bring their money. And when they do, that will be the support. That's why there are rich people in the Christian church. So we also have to recognize that there is a middle class in all of these countries and deal, you know, bring them the gospel, because they will be that which supports the work of the church in that country, believe me. So in Venezuela, let me tell you what happened. They said, no, Westcott, it won't work, it just won't work. I said, let's try it in Portadas. Steel mill city, all kinds of factories in the city. So we bought a home for the missionary, but it was big, and it had a big inner courtyard. And we said, start, and it was right in the middle of the middle class. You know, there was no barrios around for miles. Right in the middle of the middle class, we said, start Bible classes. See what happens. That was 1 year ago. The last Board of Commission Services meeting, we bought property for a congregation. And that congregation will build its own church. Our gift was the property. They'll build the church. He's got a middle class church growing by leaps and bounds. These people are hungry for the gospel also. Only they don't know it. They don't know what they're hungry for. By the way, that's something else we've got to correct. I hear preachers talking all the time about all these poor people in the world being hungry for the gospel. They don't even know the gospel. How can they be hungry for something they don't know? They're hungry. They don't know what they're hungry for. We have the answer. We have the food. The other thing that we have to do when we talk about cities is we have to be prepared to deal with people and try to meet their needs. I don't know how many of you know about the Nehemiah program in New York City. I don't have time, obviously, to explain that to you. But it's a major approach, an innovative and major approach to people in the central city. In central core cities across this country, we have churches, all denominations, and these are always all being supported with what we call subsidy. Bad word. Should never use that word. It's a demeaning word, but it's a word, you know, that we've come to use. But however, these churches are all being supported by resources from other people. And we do this, and we pour millions of dollars into these churches to keep them alive. For what? For a community that doesn't want them. And a community that is so mixed up and so upset. So a group of Christians in New York, including some Lutherans, got together and said, let's try something new. Now, I've been involved in inner city work. I was pastor in Detroit. I was chairman of the Urban Mission Committee. I was chairman of the Mission Board, all that nonsense. We spent millions of dollars trying to figure out how to bring the gospel to people in the central city. We had storefronts. We had all this nonsense, which nothing worked. I'd like to have all that money now, believe me. What we're doing now is a simple process. We're bringing people back to the central city by enabling them to buy houses on a $20,000 a year income. It's working. Go to New York. Go to the Bronx. Go to Brownsville. Take a look. Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod didn't know what was happening to it. I really literally did. I conned them into $1 million just to you know, get this project off the ground, and the Roman Catholics put it in. They wouldn't put it in until the Lutherans did, but we did. And they put three in. The Episcopalians put three in. We have a building fund that is a revolving fund, no interest charge. Houses are being sold for $34,000 at 9% interest to people who earn $20,000 a year. What's happening is we're bringing people back to the city. They're taking up ownership. They have a house and a piece of land. Crime is disappearing. Churches and schools are beginning to have people coming to them. And I would anticipate in 3 years, every one of those churches, including our own, will be totally self-supporting. They have to be prepared to do that kind of thing also. It is not business as usual. It never will be from this moment on. And the church that says, we've never done it that way before, is a dying church. But those are the seven last words of a dying church. Count them. We've never done it that way before. We've never done it that way before. Right. Seven words. Dying church. It says those words. Don't ever say them. Don't ever say them. And don't ever let your people say them. We live in a world of constant change. One thing doesn't change, and that's the gospel. I didn't say we should not keep that. But I'm talking about everything else. Yes, you had a question. I'm sorry. I just got carried away. I'm tied down. Sorry, just a minute. I just got to remember where I am. Okay, fine. Go ahead.
My question dealt with the inner cities, and you touched on that quite a bit in your answer to the urban problem. Have we reached the point yet where we are opening more churches in the inner city than we're closing?
No, no. And hopefully we will, okay? I think the closing has leveled off. Now, in Detroit, we closed 20 churches in about 20 years in that central city core. The membership in Detroit, in Lutheran Church, Missouri City, went almost down to zero because of that. But I think that's now stabilized. And as other cities, I've had four requests from other cities to explain that Nehemiah thing in New York. As other cities begin to look at new and innovative ways of either bringing the people back or making the people who live there stable, I think we will see a growth. I should also say that it does take as much of a daring and adventuresome spirit to go to, you know, the wilds of New Guinea as it does to go into the inner city. It does take a special breed of cat to do that. And someone who's willing to make a commitment. You know, we heard that last night, and I can't emphasize that enough. Now, in these ministries, whether you go into New Guinea or into Venezuela, or into the inner city, the central city. The commitment is terribly important. I know it's not possible to look down into the future, but I would say that if in your mind at least there is not a commitment to a lifelong ministry in these unique ministries, I'm not talking about some nice suburban thing. That may be 3 years and you should get out. Who knows? But I'm talking about a commitment to people who are unsettled, who are depressed, or who are totally in that unreached people group going overseas now, okay? There needs to be a commitment. What happens to a group of people when you finally have become a part of them and you're sharing with them and then you say to them, goodbye, and they never see you again? Now, I know there are reasons for it, but I'm saying at least mentally we need to change our thinking about going overseas or going into a specialized ministry like the inner city in this country and say, well, I'll give it a whirl. Don't give it a whirl. It'd be much better if you just, you know, left the world alone and did whatever you're going to do. There needs to be that definite long-term commitment on our part today to that. Okay. Anything else? Yes, sir. Well, right now we're using laymen. That's something that I instituted when I came in. I don't believe clergymen are ever trained to be business administrators of mission fields or of churches. I think that's a terrible misuse of talent. On top of it, the guys really screw things up so badly it isn't funny. So we have now instituted, when a new field, for example, opens like Sierra Leone, just opened, the team that went out was whom? It was a missionary and a layman, a business manager, accountant, builder, etc. Okay? These are many times retired people who are good and healthy and ready to go. These are sometimes people who give up their job and are willing to go overseas. So we're using laymen now as business administrators in all of our as many as possible, our mission fields and our partner churches. I anticipate, however, that we need to do some We need to take a hard look at the vast resources that we have in the lay people of this church body. Not just the retired people. You know, we're using them in the labors for Christ. But I'm talking about lay people who want and have a burden to carry this gospel. We have things, I think, that can prepare them. For example, St. Paul, the DE program, Director of Evangelism Program. We have MAR kinds of programs. I don't know, you know. I am convinced, for example, that it is an absolute and total waste to use an ordained clergyman in linguistics today. I really am. I think with the shortage that's involved, we can't afford to do it, and that we can use lay people, running them through an MAR program so they get the Hebrew and the Greek. They got to have the original languages. And, you know, the linguistic skills, okay? They can go and do the job. So I believe in the future, in answer to your question, we will be, even if we don't want to, we're going to be forced into making a far wider use of our lay talent and people than we have in the past. Right now, we're working at it. We recognize the resources that are there. We do use, in Japan and Taiwan, we use young people, graduates from colleges in the VYM program, not ordained clergymen. Okay, so we're moving, but not enough. Good question. They're not Christians, friend. Neither Mormons nor Jehovah Witnesses are Christian. Yes, sir, we compete like mad with them. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Lord, they're as heathen as the day is long. They're going to hell, just sure as the poor pagan who worships his idol is going to hell. I wish I had the time to really talk with you. I could talk about China yet. We haven't talked about China. I was there last August. And all the, you know, this... We got unbelievable opportunities, and part of what we have to learn, why I'm so hung up on the strategy bit, is that it is the Lord who opens the door, and we may be very impatient about going into a place. He hasn't opened that door. We've got to remember that. That's why we've got to have the kind of eyes that recognize the open door. We have to have the kind of eyes that recognize not an open door, but a slit in the door. I got some time. I got 10 minutes. Can I share something with you? I got a letter shortly after I took the job from a man who lived in Burma. Burma is a totally closed country. Totally. It's one of those countries closed so tight that for years, nobody could even come in to visit from the outside. There's no evidence that Burma even knows there's a 20th century. Believe me. It's terrible. Most depressing country I've ever been in. They opened up the doors a little bit so that you could go in on a 7-day visa. That's all. And you have to leave. Well, I got a letter from this country from a guy named Saul Michael, and he said to me in the letter, this is my name. My name is Saul Michael. I consider myself a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod because I've been reading the Lutheran Witness for 10 years. Now, I don't know of anybody else who could ever dare make that statement about the Lutheran Witness. But anyway, he did. And this is the result of some good ladies group, I'm assuming, got a name and were sending the Lutheran Witness. He'd been reading it for 10 years. And he said in his letter, he wanted us to come and establish the church there. Okay? Well, I read the letter and said, that's interesting, and I threw it in a wastebasket. Now, what am I, how am I going to do Burma? Yeah, I got so many other things to do, I don't worry about Burma. Well, I learned a very good lesson. A year later, he wrote me another letter. And this time I said to Dr. Liu Now, who's the area secretary for Asia, on your next trip into Hong Kong, make a side trip, go into Burma, to see if there's anything there. See if you can find this joker. So he did. To our utter astonishment, they only found him. Found a Lutheran church in Burma, started by the Swedish mission years and years and years ago, 75, 8500 years ago. Okay? One church, old man named J.J. Andrews is the pastor, getting ready to die, really worried about who's going to take over the church. And he's gone to Sweden, and they say, no, you go to the Anglicans. And he says, no, I want to be Lutheran. All right, so we discover the church, and we discover the man, Saul Michael. Saul Michael's a layman of that church, wants to be the pastor. How in the world are we going to do this? You can't bring him out, it's against the law. You can't send a missionary in, it's against the law. So how in the world are we going to make him a pastor? Simple. You will not believe, if anybody tells me that the Lord is not in control, I'm really mindful to shoot him, because it's so absolutely ridiculous. He's in total control of everything. When the Lord said, when Christ said he knows when a sparrow falls to the ground, you better believe he does. That doesn't mean he willed that sparrow, but he knows. And a lot of times he wills things. Listen to this. Listen how stupid the law is. But stupid in our favor. If you mail into Burma books in the Burmese language, they will be taken and burned. You can mail all the English books in you want. Now, you tell me why. Well, I'll tell you why. Because Saul Michael and J.J. Andrews read and speak English. So what we're doing right now is we're conducting a seminary in Burma. Nobody knows it. You don't dare publish this because it would close the door. It's open, you know, you can't even see the crack. It's so small. Well, we're sending in TE, you know, books, that workbooks, all this sort of stuff, as we train him into the pastoral ministry. We're conducting a seminary. Once every 6 months, we send in a missionary for 7 days. Now, we have to be careful. The missionary has to go in there and not run around and let everybody know where he is. When I was in Burma for 2 days, I was followed. Oh, I'll tell you, to get into the country, I had to sign a statement that I would not preach or teach the Christian religion. If I did, I'd be exported. I've never signed a statement like that in my life. But I wanted to get in. I wanted to meet these people, so I signed a statement. I was followed from the moment I left the customs shed. Openly followed. So we got to be careful. So we send a missionary in, and for 7 or 6 days, he reviews, he works with, you know, how many do you think we've got there now? Saul Michael has grown to 4. 4 young men studying for the ministry of the Lutheran Church in Missouri, and they will never be on our roster. And we will never claim, not in my lifetime, we'll never claim this as a mission of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. But this is the exciting things that are going on today. And if you don't have the eye, see, I'm never again will I ignore a letter. Never. The Lord taught me something. Because he was opening that door and showing us how to get in. So we're conducting a seminary in Burma. It is unbelievably exciting at what's going on in this world. And that only is evidence of the fact that the Lord desire that men know about him and love him is at work. There may be 37 closed countries in this world, but I'll tell you something. That doesn't stop the Lord. The door swing both ways. How many times have you walked through a door and it's hit you in the rear end? Because it's got double action hinges. We know, we're so dumb. We say, 37 countries closed. Well, that's marvelous. Let them be closed. We just write them off. Oh, no. No, the Lord brings them out. 300,000 students, mostly from the Arab countries, are in this country attending our universities. Postgrads who will return to their countries. The question you need to ask is, how will they return? Anti-American, anti-Christian? Or will they be as God intended them to be when he brought them over here? Missionaries. Into countries where we can't send missionaries. Think about it. The end of the story for Ethiopia is tragic. It began with that guy in Acts chapter 8. It ended in 1977 with Mengistu, who now runs the show, a cruel, despot, communist dictator. But you see what's so sad is that Mengistu was in this country for 10 years, from 67 to 77. And when he went back to Ethiopia to take over, what did he do? What was his first act? Kicked out all Americans, second, placed the church under heavy persecution, and closed the largest, wasn't it, Al, the largest broadcasting, ROVG, largest Christian broadcasting station in Africa. Whatever he learned in this country turned him against Christianity and against Americans. Be careful. Paul said to the Colossians, tucked away in chapter 4, some very great evangelism principles. He said, be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Terribly important. Smile. Teach your people to smile. Lord, teach them to smile. We Lutherans don't know how to smile. When it comes to our faith, teach them to be happy. And they only learn that when they see you. Would you please remember, as you stand in front of that congregation on Sunday morning, what your members are when they walk out is what they've seen. And if you're up there, sad, sober-faced, going through the motions, that's the way their Christianity will be. You turn them on. If you're excited about your faith, they will be. I have enough. Okay. Lack of information, primarily. I do not believe our people are not interested. I don't believe that they're ready to go. I mean, our people spend money by the bucketfuls. You know, Schuller's castle got $1 million from a single Lutheran because he didn't know that there was anything in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that needed his million. All right? You know, our people have got the resources. They somehow, we have not done a good job of telling them what, you know, what we're doing and what the needs are. Now, I've got a budget of $12 million for an 86-87, please the Lord. You know. But already I know that $3 million of that budget is going to have to depend upon people dying. Because we're not getting the resources to support that small budget. It ought to be $50 million instead of $12 million. But I'm only going to get $8 million from the people. Okay? And I'm not blaming the system or anything else. I'm just saying our people don't know. I really believe, as I think back on my years as a pastor, that our people are all excited. Missions and Synod was always in front because I guess because I was a former missionary. I don't know. But all I know is that I've always helped my people to understand why they're here. And when they do, you know, there's an excitement that comes. And you know, I'm appalled at the lack of knowledge that our people have of how and what the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is doing in missions. Oh, they know all about the nitty-gritty, you know, navel-staring arguments that we conduct. But they really don't know what's going on in a forward-looking way. And lots going on. We have, you know, we're hoping to turn this around. We've got communications department pretty well locked into now doing things. I, for example, when I went to China, I carried a video camera with me. In fact, on my last 2-3 trips, I carried a video camera, little Panasonic. I brought back from China 8 2-hour tapes. That's 16 hours of tape. Edited? Sure, I'm not a professional. But it can, you know, it's got my voice on it because, it's, you know, that's how it works. And if it's edited, you know, we can send out half-hour tapes to our congregation. Everybody's got a VCR. If they don't, they can get one. You know? We can begin the education process that way. We have got so much technology available that it's pathetic. You know, my statement usually is, now, the Mormons bought a satellite. It didn't take them very long to discover why the Lord put that up there. Now, they don't even know the Lord, but they discovered very quickly that they could promulgate their message on any given day in every one of their congregations, okay? The head of the Mormon church can speak to every congregation, every stake, there and around the world. By the time we decide what that satellite's up there for, there will no longer be satellites. There'll be something else. We have to argue about for, you know, all this. It costs a bit of money to buy a satellite. Sure, it costs money. What have we got it for? I don't really understand why we have it, except to use it in order to get the word out. And that's why things are being invented today with such rapidity, because all of this was there on day one. The Lord is now permitting it to be discovered so that his word can get out more efficiently, more quickly, and more economically. When I went to Africa in 1948, it took us 8 weeks to get there. I can fly around the world 30 times in 8 weeks today. Let's move. Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions is welcome to do so in